From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is James Butte. He's managing editor and host of Daybreak Africa. Our topic on this edition of the program, changing of the guard in Nigeria. Our guest, J. Peter Pham, director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council. That's a think tank here in Washington. And in a stinging rebuke to the ruling People's Democratic Party, which many voters say failed to tackle corruption and allowed a deadly insurgency to take root, opposition leader Muhammadu Buhari, a former general and Muslim from the north, won a decisive victory over incumbent Goodluck Jonathan. Mr. Buhari's victory ends the 16-year rule of the People's Democratic Party in Nigeria and marks the first democratic transfer of power between civilians of different parties. Much of Nigeria's post-colonial history has been shaken by military coups. Voting this year had been delayed by 6 weeks as the government of Goodluck Jonathan launched an offensive against the extremist group Boko Haram. Foreign leaders, including U.S. President Barack Obama, praised the two leaders and Nigerians for holding a peaceful vote. There have been no reports of post-election violence, a major change from 2011, when news of Jonathan's victory over Buhari sparked violence in the north and killed some 800 people. We'll talk with our expert, J. Peter Pham, about the significance and implications of Buhari's victory, not only for Africa's most populous country, but also for the continent at large. Prior to his post as director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, Peter Pham was professor of justice studies, political science, and African studies at James Madison University in the state of Virginia. An expert on international relations and strategic issues with a focus on African politics and security, Peter Pham has authored over 300 essays and reviews and is the author, editor, or translator of over a dozen books on these topics. He is frequently invited to testify before the U.S. Congress and brief senior administration officials and has served as an advisor to the United Nations, foreign governments, and multinational corporations. And, of course, he is no stranger to the Voice of America. He is a frequent panelist on Encounter, and we are delighted now to welcome him as our sole guest on Press Conference USA. Peter Pham, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Carol. It's a pleasure to be with you and James.
So nice to see you in person.
I'm delighted to welcome my colleague James as well.
Thank you, Carol.
Well, Peter Pham, we've been talking about these elections in Nigeria, the obstacles, and here we are now with a victory by the opposition, Muhammadu Buhari. Your reaction, how did he do it?
Well, retired General Muhammadu Buhari, I think, won the election not only on the issues that he raised during the campaign, the effectiveness of the fight against Boko Haram, the security implications, the competence, actually, of the management of the war, the management of the economy, the questions of corruption. But he also won it by very carefully putting together a coalition that transcended the usual ethnic and regional divides of Nigerian politics, bringing into it several parties that had run independent campaigns in the past, including, I think, pivotally, the Action Congress of Nigeria, which polled very strongly last time around, 2011, in southwestern Nigeria, which was absorbed into the All Progressives Congress and delivered their key constituencies in that area. So that at the end of the day, retired General Buhari won not only the North, which he was expected to do well in, but large segments in the southwest of the country to score a 55% of the vote nationally to incumbent President Goodluck Jonathan's 45%.
And you said that his win transcended, to some extent, ethnic, religious, and regional lines. Would you say that this was a vote really for Buhari as much as it was a vote against Goodluck Jonathan?
Rather than a vote for or against, I would say it was a vote for change. The People's Democratic Party, the PDP, has governed Nigeria through three presidents since 1999 when the military handed power back to civilians. And after 16 years in power, there was a fatigue that set in. Literally, a good number of the voters had never known any other party in power except the PDP. So there was a desire for change. You saw that in the interviews of many voters. They were seeking a change, not necessarily against someone or for someone, but change. But certainly there was that also that element of strong support for Buhari, especially in the north, where he had run three times before for president. This was the fourth run he succeeded. And then there was in the South a lot of frustration, especially in the Southwest, against the Goodluck Jonathan administration for perhaps failing to deliver on all the promises of 4 years ago.
Let me turn to my colleague James for a question.
I'm very happy to be here with you, Mr. Pham. You mentioned the coalition that was put together by the Buhari camp. How do you think he can sustain that?
The easy part is over, so to speak. Winning the election, certainly it was a tribute to him and his campaign organization that he did win this election. But now it's a disparate coalition of regional interests, former PDP governors and other officials who had grown disaffected with their own party and defected from the party. So very different interests with different needs that will have to be kept together, not only with positions in the federal government, the executive branch, but also they've won the majority in the Senate and the House of Representatives. But keeping this coalition together is going to be a tough task for the next 4 years. So it's going to be a challenge.
Ask the question, because take a state like Rivers State. Under normal conditions, Rivers State will go to the PDP. Because of the defection within the ruling PDP, the governor of Rivers State was a PDP member. Now he defected. And so what happened, Buhari won. But we know that in the South, in Rivers State, where the oil comes from, we have the old Niger Delta group. They were getting government subsidy. What happened if Buhari does not continue? That's an interest that is going to force the governor there to begin to listen to his people.
You're absolutely right. There are going to be numerous challenges. One of the big challenges coming up this year would have faced either man who won the election, whether President Jonathan continued or Buhari, is the amnesty and the payments for the former militants in the Niger Delta end this year. And what are these militants going to do? Jobs have not been created for them. Many of them have not even been retrained for anything, much less finding labor. And that's going to be an issue. The issue, of course, the Northeast, the government, to its credit, the last 6 weeks, there were many skeptics, but the military campaign against Boko Haram has succeeded. Just the day before the election, Gwoza, the headquarters of the militants, was taken back by the government. But now the military part is over, but now there has to be the social, economic, and political development and inclusion to prevent the militants from coming back. But all this has to be done against the backdrop of Nigeria, the government at least, having fewer resources. Although the Nigerian economy continues to grow at a respectable rate, government resources come primarily over 80% from the oil sector. The price of oil in the global markets is half of what it was a year ago. So the government's going to have fewer resources, but expectations are raised on the part of the voters. And this is going to be a real challenge for the incoming president.
We know that there are many elections in Africa this year. Nigeria gone, Burundi is next. We also know that Ethiopia, all these countries are coming up. Is there a particular lesson from the Nigerian election that you think some of these countries or the opposition in those countries can draw from?
Very much so. I think the Nigerian election was very important. And the fact that not only was it held in largely fair and transparent conditions, but that the loser was very gracious in conceding victory to the winner, calling him to congratulate him, which is perhaps is pro forma in Europe and North America, but is still a rarity to be remarked at in Africa, and that the two have reached out to each other. That's all really a lesson for the entire country, because Nigeria is a very complex country. Over 250 different ethnic groups in the country, fissures regionally between the north and the south, and within the south between southwest, southeast, northeast, northwest, religious fissures. Nigeria has the largest Muslim community in Africa. It also has the largest Christian community in one country in Africa. And so all the excuses that can be made for not having democratic elections, for not having transparency, it's too large, it's too complicated, go away if Nigeria does it well. If Nigeria, a country as large as it is, most populous, largest economy in Africa with all this diversity, can hold an election like this and have a peaceful transfer of power, then any country that's smaller, which is all of them, cannot raise that same excuse. It's no longer a valid excuse.
Well, Peter Pham, in relation to James's question, you wrote an article right after the election in U.S. News and World Report, Nigeria Votes, Africa Wins. And you said here that the winner will not only have to finish up the battle with Boko Haram, whose insurgency cost the lives of more than 10,000 people last year and prompted the 6-week delay in the polls earlier this year, but he will have to win the ensuing peace, by a combination of political, economic, and social development programs, to which you alluded to earlier. Has Muhammadu Buhari articulated a plan to finish up the battle against Boko Haram? How different will he approach the insurgency than his predecessor? And what about a plan along the lines political, economic, and social development in order to maintain stability?
Well, we know that political, economic, and social development are key to winning any counterinsurgency. We also know that the threat of Boko Haram has entered a new phase in that the military threat has largely been defeated, but now it's a terrorist threat, which require not military resources so much as police and intelligence resources. The issue with General Buhari, and this is to be fair to him, he was running as a challenger, and a challenger in any political competition the world over has the easy job of complaining about how the incumbent has not done things well. And so you attack the incumbent's performance, and you don't necessarily articulate a detailed program because that's not your role as a challenger. So to be fair to him, it wouldn't have served his political interest to do so, but now he has to govern. And so one either hopes that he has a plan that he simply did not choose to unveil during the course of the campaign, or he and his team very quickly come up with one, because that's going to be needed. It's now no longer enough to complain about the guy who came before you. It's now yours.
And let me remind our listeners that you're listening to PCUSA on The Voice of America. Our guest is J. Peter Pham. He's director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council. And I'm joined by my colleague, James Butte. He's the managing editor and host of Daybreak Africa.
General Buhari said during his acceptance speech that one of the things he's going to do is the fight against corruption and then to finish up Boko Haram. He comes from the north. And if it's really true that Boko Haram is from the north, being this allegation that some wealthy people in the north have been funding Boko Haram. So if that is the case, is it possible that he can use his influence to end the Boko Haram terror?
Certainly, he was closer to the action, so to speak, and perhaps has a better understanding than those who are not from the region. But two things, and this is where I think it's in the phase of managing expectations. Although General Buhari is from the north, the insurgency, Boko Haram, was primarily in the northeast, where the ethnic group is the Kanuri, not the predominant Hausa Fulani of the Emirate states. So there is a difference, and in fact, the Kanuri have resentments and questions about their own marginalization within the north. So there's a limit to how far that can go. And certainly in the outgoing administration of Goodluck Jonathan, the national security advisor, Colonel Sambu Dasuki, was also a northerner and a Muslim, and in fact, the son of a former sultan of Sokoto and the nephew of another. So he was also in the north, but he had his trials dealing with this group. So I think we have to manage expectations. We can hope for the best, and hopefully he sticks with the planning, somehow comes up with the resources. That's going to be the real issue for not just the security threat of Boko Haram, but all the issues now here is the resources in a period when government revenues are diminishing because of oil prices going down and borrowing costs have gone up and going to be more difficult. In the past 2 weeks, we've had Standard & Poor's downgrade Nigeria's sovereign credit rating to below junk status. Fitch has put out an advisory that the outlook was negative just the day before the election results were announced. So unless that's reversed, it's going to be very expensive and challenging for Nigeria even to raise funds on the international capital markets.
So on corruption, he has also promised he's going to do away with this so-called culture of impunity and then the evil corruption. I was reading his speech, and he ruled out going after Jonathan. But some people have said that a list has already been put together by the Buhari camp of people who they do not want to leave the country, suspected of corruption. So how is he going to end this impunity?
The key thing is, in order for things to move forward, in many respects, although one would like to see justice and accountability for those who have done bad deeds in the past, it's more important to not be perceived as a political witch hunt, but rather that systems be put in place and to be, again, fair to the Jonathan administration. Perhaps they did not act as quickly or as effectively as necessary, but when they created a office of a coordinating minister for the economy, coordinating several different ministries, and gave it to the finance minister, Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, they've begun to institute some systems. So the fight has started. They've eliminated several hundred thousand ghost workers who are drawing salaries, you know, they didn't exist. They've made it a little more difficult to bill the government for things, services that were never tendered. So some systems have been built. Now, perhaps they didn't move as rapidly or as aggressively as necessary, but there's something to be built upon. And the key thing is to not throw out the child with the bathwater.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is J. Peter Pham. He's director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council. We're discussing the outcome of recent elections in Nigeria, the significance of Muhammadu Buhari's victory over incumbent Goodluck Jonathan. And joining me on the program is James Butte. He's managing editor and host of the popular Daybreak Africa. And he's an old colleague from our days at the former West Africa magazine.
What a great day. Yes.
I'm Carol Castiel, and this is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA, or connect with us on Facebook via Carol Castiel VOA, or you may send feedback via email to PCUSA@voanews.com. Tell us where you're from and how you listen to the program. Here's a big shout out to all our Nigerian listeners. Congratulations on the conduct of your free and fair election. And a special hello to Ms. Sefiat Oyebola from Ibadan in Oyo State, who liked us on our Facebook page. And now a question from James.
Mr. Fan, I alluded earlier to the numerous elections that are coming up in Africa, very important ones, Democratic Republic of Congo particularly, and Burundi. There's something that seems to be developing where it seems that perhaps those presidents in those countries are trying to manipulate the constitution so that they can continue in office. Just this week, I was reading a statement from President Barack Obama where he had called President Joseph Kabila of the Democratic Republic of Congo, saying that the U.S., in their discussion, he emphasized the importance of credible election and peaceful elections that reflect the constitution of the Democratic Republic of Congo. So what do you make of countries or leaders and the continuation in office, although even though they are barred to do that?
Thank you, James. In particular, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, the Constitution not only sets a limit of 2 terms on the presidency, but it goes even a step further. Article 220 of the Congolese Constitution says that limit of 2 consecutive terms may not be amended. Other constitutions leave that kind of open, and you see various presidents trying to change. But the Congo's Constitution is very clear. 2 terms, consecutive terms, and this article may not be changed any way, shape, or form. And what we've seen, unfortunately, is President Kabila, who's already been in power for a decade and a half, trying to get around it. There was an attempt in January to say that they weren't changing the term limits, but they wouldn't hold elections until after a census was held. Well, a census of a country that large takes a bit of time, several years, and it was kind of a backhanded way to get a extension. That was defeated after street protests, but dozens of people, depending on whose body count you choose to believe, at least 3 dozen, mainly students, peacefully demonstrating, were shot dead. We've seen also in March a breakup where the U.S. Agency for International Development had brought some activists, 3 hip-hop musicians from Myanmar, the Senegalese group that opposed President Wade's attempt to get a 3rd term, to come down and share their experiences with Congolese pro-democracy activists, as well as a citizen activist, grassroots activist from Burkina Faso, from Bali Citoyen, the group there. And they had a small meeting. 40 people showed up. There was going to be a press conference followed by a concert by the musicians. It was broken up by soldiers. The musicians were arrested. A U.S. diplomat was held briefly. And a number of journalists from France and Britain were also arrested. So there's a trigger sensitivity. So that's really of a concern. And even in small countries, unfortunately, we're seeing very disturbing signs. In Guinea-Conakry, for example, we've seen the president invoke Ebola as an excuse to replace the civilian minister in charge of internal territorial administration with a general, a uniformed man, using Ebola again as the excuse for postponing local government elections that are overdue by several years and leaving his appointees in place to run the election, which has for the presidency, which is due in October, all of which raises really serious concerns about the transparency, fairness, and legitimacy of this process. So we hope that these 2 countries and many of the others in Africa that have elections coming up take a lesson from Nigeria. If a country as large, as complex, as riven with divisions in Nigeria can pull this off, there's no reason, there's no legitimate excuse why a similar process can't work on a far more manageable scale.
Peter Pham, let's take a look at how Muhammadu Buhari's governing style will differ from that of Goodluck Jonathan. And we can look at who he was before, his past record. He said himself, even though he's a retired general, that an extremely austere, and I think perhaps that's part of what attracted people to him, because of they're fed up with the corruption, and he seems to be a very simple man. He says that, "I'm a converted Democrat ready to operate under democratic norms." You know, what do we know about him, and what does that say about how he may govern henceforth?
Certainly, we hope, this is an example where we hope the past does not predict the future. In 1983, then General Buhari overthrew a democratically elected president and started a whole series of coups and counter-coups that bedeviled Nigeria for two decades. He was in power just about 20 months before another military man followed him and did to him what he had done to someone else. But those 20 months were disastrous on many levels, on the human rights and freedom level. Many people remember the soldiers in the streets with whips ordering people into orderly lines, but there were the human rights violations. Fela Kuti, the great musician, was given a 10-year sentence during this crackdown. There were press repressions. The economy took a nosedive when the government tried to set prices for agricultural goods. That doesn't work in any system, never works in economics. So there were a lot of things that went very badly. But that's three decades ago. He says he's converted. And to be fair to him, he has run and lost in three elections as a candidate and taken his licking at the polls. And this fourth time he won. So I think the people of Nigeria are willing to give him the benefit of the doubt. And those of us in the international community, I think, cautiously will do the same because, you know, the people of Nigeria have spoken and we should at least respect their judgment and see if he is indeed that converted Democrat that and repented, if you will, of what he did in the past.
And in the face of the impact of lower oil prices on the Nigerian economy, did he offer any economic platform to deal with unemployment and so forth?
To be fair to him, he ran like any opposition candidate, complaining about the woes of the present, but he didn't articulate a plan. And challengers often don't do that. We see that in our own country in races from local county races all the way up to the presidency. It happens that way. So to be fair to him, I'm not going to hold him to a standard that one doesn't hold anywhere. But we hope he has a plan, if not that he has a team together that will make a plan, because that really will constrain his ability to deliver on the promises of his race. On the other hand, he did assemble a broad coalition. He has a vice president, Yemi Osinbajo, who comes from the Southwest, who's a Yoruba in ethnicity, a Christian, in fact, a lay preacher at a large church on Banana Island, and is the son-in-law of the man, Chief Obafemi Awolowo, who is hailed as the leader of the Yoruba. So it brings together actually two large constituencies, just even on the ethnic level in the country. So there's a, you know, there perhaps, you know, I'm willing to give every benefit of the doubt and hope that this is the dawning of a new chapter, a new day.
Is there a lot of healing to be done among the polity in Nigeria? Are there tensions that his candidacy and his vice president need to reach out and try to, you know, heal or reconcile?
Very, very definitely. It did not get as bad, and we're, I think, all very relieved that this election did not result in the post-election violence that unfortunately has characterized Nigeria's previous elections, including the last one. But there clearly, if one looks at the map, that there is clearly a regional divide still in the vote. The coalition that assembled around the APC won by winning the North consistently and winning the Southwest. But it's very clear on the map that the Southeast voted in overwhelming numbers, very lopsided numbers, 90% margins for the incumbent president, Goodluck Jonathan, and the PDP. So there's a large section, it's the section of the country that produces a lot of its wealth, that feels they lost. And there's a real danger if they don't feel included.
You mentioned the coalition that the All Progressive Congress Party put together, Buhari. But in African elections, most often we see And I don't know, I'd like for you to address this. Whether in the case of Nigeria, what role did ethnicity and religion, particularly religion in the case of Nigeria, what role did these two play?
There's no denying that ethnicity, religion, regional differences have always and probably will always play a role in Nigerian politics. But in this particular election, I think a couple of things are. One is Buhari, whose base is the Muslim, predominantly Muslim north of the country. General Buhari made a concerted effort. He reached out. He appointed a vice presidential candidate, who is now the vice president-elect, who was a Christian, and not just a Christian, but actually a lay preacher in a church from the Southwest. So he purposely tried to bridge that gap. So the religious gap, he tried to bridge it very consistently. The regional gap, the ethnic gap, his vice presidential candidate was a Yoruba from the Southwest. But there was also in this election, for the first time, some issues-based splitting. The Southwest is the part of the country that is dynamic economically, but it doesn't have the resource wealth of the Southeast. Southeast is oil, natural gas. The Southwest of the country is where all the new economies are. It's Lagos, the largest city in Africa, 20-some million people. We have the telecoms industry, Nollywood, Nigeria's entertainment industry. All that new wealth production is in the Southwest, and many of those people turned out for the opposition in part because they felt their opportunities for economic growth were constrained by the system as it stood.
That leads me to ask you, Peter Pham, what about diversifying the economy away from oil? Do we have a sense that Buhari is planning to do that, since there seems to be so much other potential for other industries?
To be fair, again, to the outgoing administration, Goodluck Jonathan's government the last few years has tried to push the building of infrastructure, because infrastructure is needed if you're going to develop other sectors. Roads, they have either repaved or laid over 20,000 kilometers of paved surface in Nigeria. Now, for a country that large, that may not seem a lot, but it's still a great deal considering what the infrastructure they inherited. They've also tried to push electrification, trying to double the electrical grid. Again, that still leaves a big deficit. Some real attempts. The outgoing finance ministers pushed an agenda of diversifying the economy. And in fact, Nigeria's economy is less reliant on oil today than it ever has been in the past. But the problem is government revenues are heavily reliant on the oil more than the economy as a whole. And so to build out this infrastructure, because roads aren't going to build themselves, electricity isn't going to come in itself, although with the privatization that occurred under Jonathan, we're hoping that's why Nigeria is one of the partners in the U.S.-sponsored Power Africa initiative launched by President Obama. But all these things, in order for it to happen, you have to have government spending and infrastructure. But you can't do that if 80% of government revenue is coming from one source, oil, and oil prices are falling. So this is the bind that the president-elect finds himself in. In order to diversify the economy, he needs to invest in the economy, but he can't invest with what he doesn't have, and that's the problem.
And before we close, J. Peter Pham, what about elections coming up? Aren't there some elections for state legislatures and governors? What is the significance of those elections, and how will that either help or hinder Muhammadu Buhari?
Well, first, before we even talk about those elections, we're waiting for the final results on all of the Senate and House of Representatives races, which were held the same day as the presidential election. The Independent National Electoral Commission prioritized getting the presidential results out. I expect that the opposition, the All Progressives Congress, will win a majority in both houses of parliament. But how large is that majority and how large the PDP minority is going to be is going to affect the ability of President-elect Buhari to govern on the national level. And then we have on April 11th, the elections expected for the state governors who hold a lot of power. Nigeria is a federation. It's a federal system. And then the state legislatures who also have a great deal of say in how money is spent within states. And I think what we're going to add is a tapestry. It's not a monolithic system anymore. And there's going to have to be compromises between the federal level and the state level and within the governments. And I think all this is healthier. It's not efficient necessarily. So there's going to be frustration to go around and expectations to be managed. But I think it's healthier institutionally for Nigeria's democracy going forward.
J. Peter Pham is the director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council and our go-to person for Africa issues. Well, thank you so much for taking time to come in and share your insights about Nigeria's historic election.
Thank you for having me.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Marty Curtius, and joining me on the program was James Butte, managing editor and host of Daybreak Africa. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.